Session number 14974, Paul Armstrong, Reel 11.
Mr. P. Armstrong, Reel 11. We've been talking about this very long march up and down France, really, Mr. Armstrong. How were you able to maintain the men's march discipline when there was so much disappointment, movement, the fog of war itself? What effects was that having?
I think the main thing was that we explained to the men when we had to turn back that there was a possibility of us being cut off and would be no use to anyone. That, once it had penetrated, and observing the poor refugees swarming down the roads, more or less convinced them that this was correct, we were able to withdraw better than I expected. And there were certain incidents that really kept the men, I'm not going to say interested, but kept them in the picture. For instance, there was one case where we came to a wood, and in a clearing in this wood was an RAF unit. They had a petrol Bowser, they had a 3-ton truck, they had a 1500 weight, they had a person, or they had all the equipment, all the transport needed, but no plane. You know, I asked them what they were doing about it, and they said they were waiting for orders. And I said, well, I have a feeling you're not going to get any orders, because most of the RAF have been obliterated by now. I said, if I were you, and I have no authority whatever to say this, if I were you, I would take your people back to the base camp at Rouen, leaving one vehicle for any RAF personnel that may be coming to this map reference, and I think you'll be doing the right thing. Whether he did, I don't know. But my men jeered at these RAF men, saying there weren't any bloody use. Regrettably, within 48 hours, we were watching with horror a Lysander desperately trying to escape from pursuing Luftwaffe planes. And literally, he flew under some telegraph wires, and the plane behind him, of course, moving too fast, couldn't avoid them and blew himself up on them. But we saw smoke further away, out of pretty well beyond our range of vision, and I fear that was that poor Lysander. That showed us the situation with regard to the RAF. The men had been commenting on the fact that they hadn't seen any, but they were very quiet about the RAF after that.
How close did you get to the Germans, or the Germans to you?
Well, the trouble this time was the Germans were motorised, and the German method at the time was to drive tanks through as fast as they could, in mainly the aim for pincer movements, and we were on the side of the southern pincer, so that one saw tanks going past, not very close, I admit that, but I could see why they were driving across our front. And so, of course, they couldn't be bothered to turn off, with a dent turn off, because they had an objective. And the objective was to cut off the troops in the Lav area. Other Germans, of course, were striking up towards Abbeville and Boulogne, Calais, and so on. I think the nearest we would come to were there was some lorried infantry on our right, I remember, and we were then, no, we didn't contact them at all at that time. We were pulling back on instructions, pulling back because Major Kenyon had told me that we were going back to try and form a force. And that was all the only orders I got. As I told you, maps were scarce. My Michelin tire map was the only one we had. And I was solely intent on getting back to what I hoped would be normality. Vainly hoped.
How did you feel about the possibility that this force that you were supposed to be forming had been able to keep the Germans back? Had they contacted you?
No. Kenyon didn't tell me anything about what the force was going to be. And I assumed that there would be some formation there. I had no idea that all we had were packets of men from various regiments, like the 100, well, the 91 men I had, and the one I think I mentioned, a Lieutenant McGoran, who had another packet, who'd come over before I did, and had 100 men there. Anyhow, we kept moving back as best we could. And I think that the main reason that troops didn't lose heart or anything like that was they were so sorry for the refugees. They felt it wasn't fair. As the average soldier feels, he hates to see a thing like that. He can understand troops fighting troops, but he can't understand civilians being included. We got back as far as Rouen and found that they were forming into units, and by chance my unit was positioned on the right, that is the east side of the line that they were forming, the west side extending towards the coast. And all I had was these 90 poor lads with rifles and 50 rounds of ammunition each. Nothing else was handed out to us then, except we did get rations. We were fed and we were watered and we were left to our devices. As a matter of interest, thinking about the rations reminded me that on the withdrawal a few days before, we came to a supply depot, quite a large one, with quite a considerable staff. And I thought this was an ideal opportunity to get rations for my troops and any weapons, if he had any. But the RSC officer in charge asked me for the requisition, the necessary requisition. And of course I said, possibly rather rudely, that I hadn't one, but things were rather too urgent. There was no one else but me in charge of this formation. We hadn't anything to eat. Ah, but, he said, I'm responsible for these rations. And I'm afraid, at that point, I told him that he would have a few years to meditate over his responsibility, but I wasn't going to wait any longer. Time was a little bit too short for discussion. The chaps all jeered, and some of the rather more unruly element wanted to take some rations, but I dissuaded them.
Were there other incidents where you had were given tasks?
Yes, in that area, which must have been the first series of dumps or the last series before the base camp, we came across a petrol depot which consisted really of an enormous number of petrol cans lined up on top of each other with a wire fence round them, and there was two or three very anxious looking also RASC personnel in charge. There was no officer there, but there was fortunately a sergeant major who had a little bit more appreciation of the situation, and he asked us if we would mind destroying this dump. Well, I hadn't been faced with a problem like this before, and I thought at first of taking a can or two and leading a trail of petrol, but this chap explained to me that I would need to be a long way off before we actually lit the trail to the petrol dump because of the explosion and the fire that would ensue. So we moved along the road till we had it in view, about 200 yards, and then we fired into the petrol dump, and we fired for quite a while, thinking of course rather belatedly that we only had 50 rounds per man, so I stopped this extravagant waste. And of course we also didn't have such a thing as any tracer bullets. We only had 50 ordinary rounds per man, but by chance it must have been the last shot before I stopped them firing must have caused a spark, and suddenly this dump went up, and I understood what the RSC meant. It was horrific. We moved from there as fast as we could, and I believe I'm right in saying those RSC men joined us and marched down to Rouen. We could actually see the smoke from that burning dump for, I'd say 15, 20 miles during the time we did march. As I've told you, we marched during the night and laid up where we could during the day. By that time we were becoming apprehensive of laying up during the day. It was getting on then.
In your march discipline, how were the men's feet standing up to this quite long distances of travelling? Did you still have to go through the routine of inspecting them every day or every evening?
No, I'm sorry to say we didn't inspect as we normally would have done. When they laid up and the men knew that they were going to have an hour or two's break, they were naturally, we had them told off in sections of 10 and makeshift platoons, which was the best we could do using the NSOs we had there. And as I say, I'm sorry to say that most of the march discipline fell onto the sergeant major, Miles Etherington, as I've said before and will say to my dying day, was an absolute mountain of strength. He had all he had all the good features about the best of our NCOs in the British Army. Whenever I think of warrant officers, I think of Etherington. I was sorry to hear that he was killed in Burma. I wasn't surprised because he was the sort of chap that would be right in the middle of all the fighting.
You had other officers with your group, didn't you?
Yes.
What were they like in helping you in this situation?
My friend whose mother asked me to look after him, Vane from Stockton, was extremely good. The whole of the time I was with him, whenever an order was given to him, he carried it out the best he could without me having even to think of it a second time. Whitehead, John Whitehead, yes, he was good. He wasn't quite assimilated into the Durhams at that time, but he was learning how to be a Durham. And I think Shipley joined me then, but I'm not absolutely sure. Although otherwise I can't remember anymore. We had the other two officers, but I can't remember the names. We were put onto a line on the south of the Seine, which was the line that we were supposed to keep. And I remember being instructed that as we were on the right of the line, we must, under all circumstances, keep in touch with the French. Nobody had told the French to keep in touch with us. And after the first day, I sent a sentry, a chap across, a runner, to see what the French were doing, and he said there were no Frenchmen there. So I sent a sergeant to check on that, and he came back and said there were no Frenchmen there. So I sent an officer, and he came back and agreed. So by that time, I passed word to Major Kenyon that they'd gone, and eventually word came back that we would withdraw. I think it was about that time that they decided that it was pointless trying to hold a line, that we could only try and form a self-defense, a series of self-defense units based on so many men. Because we then moved to Elbeuf, and I, with my company, was given the task of holding a bridge over the Seine against the enemy, even to the last enlisted of the troops. This was a nonsense. And it was then that they were handing me letters to various ladies in England, or parents in England, which I told them to put into my pack, because they insisted that I would get home, and obviously they felt they wouldn't. That was then where we saw the speeding panzers crossing on the north side of the Seine, which must have been troops that were driving towards Lavre, and mercifully they showed little interest in us. There was one motorcycle and sidecar German outrider came. I don't know whether it was reconnaissance or whether he'd lost his way, but we did blow him away. But apart from that, that was the only contact, physical contact, we had with the Germans. When we'd reached the stage that we felt we'd been abandoned, Tim McGoran's group, or company as they were calling us, came to take our place, and we moved down. And I remember thinking how smartly my chaps moved down to the next stopping point. And from there, we just moved in stages, hopping over units and trying it desperately. I don't know who the staff officers were, but I didn't envy them the job. It must have been horrendous for them. And think myself that the men realized that we were then in a hole, and it was no good complaining. The job to do was to get away as fast as they could move, and we honestly thought we would be forming another line somewhere with the French. We never dreamt of evacuation. we'd heard by chance, a chance listening to a radio, that the BEF had been successfully evacuated, but that was 2 or 3 days before. And by that time we anticipated that a new front was going to be formed at some place that the High Command had decided on, and all we wanted to do was get to that point and be regrouped.
What was the situation regarding food? And were you carrying your own food, or was supplies coming through to you as you moved back?
I'm sorry to say that the food situation was a calamity. There was very little food, but I must now take a chance of saying the French were terribly kind. Even though it was obvious that we were retreating, even though they'd heard about Dunkirk from the Germans and how we'd been thrown back into the sea, even though the Germans said that we'd left the French, deserted them, the people were terribly kind. And whenever we had went through a village, even past odd farmhouses, people came out and gave the troops food, which presumably they shared amongst each other, because no one complained.
How did then did you get away? You're retiring now, below the same.
Oh yes, we found that the French had literally left us, and the whoever the senior officer was, I think it was a General MacFarlane, I'm not sure, but whoever the senior officer was had decided that we would make for the coast, the coastal railway. That's right. And we got to quite a big place. Could have been Lisieux. I'm not going to be sure. But there was a truck train there. And a staff officer. And I remember him as clearly as possible saying, "Just in time, get a move on." And I thought, we can't have moved any farther than we have. And we were loaded into these trucks. And I expected we were going to move straight off. No, the driver wasn't ready. And I went along to the driver and had a chat with him. And he told me that he'd be moving, I think it was about 1/4 hour afterwards. He also was very scornful about this staff officer, saying that he didn't understand the French railways, and this chap took his orders from the French railway authorities. Anyhow, while we were chatting, I felt a little bit scruffy, so I asked if he could spare a drop of water from the engine, and he took me a little water out, and I had a shave while we waited. And then we moved off, and that drive was really, it was frightening, because we were sitting target. There's nothing more naked than a number of soldiers in a train going through land which has been defeated and where the enemy have complete air cover, air superiority. And we worried. I'll be honest, we worried, particularly when at one stage we did see crossing once again. We were lucky that they were driving for the coast and not driving south. It presumably was the next formation that would fan out to the south. But we moved along and we weren't attacked. We got right away to Cherbourg. And this would be, I think, either the 4th or the 5th of June. Because we had no idea of time. Time doesn't seem to mean much at that when you're in these sort of situations. It's survive each day. And we clattered through the town, because the rail goes right into Cherbourg, as you probably know, and we were hurried to where there was a destroyer up at the quay, and there was a lieutenant commander, RN, shouting to us to hurry up. And when we got there, my chaps were marching along with rifles slung, and as we filed up the gangway, he said, "Throw those rifles into the sea." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "We can't afford to take it, can't afford to take rifles." I've forgotten how he worked it out. It was about 100 rifles equals a man, or something stupid like that. And I said, "I will, hell." And I halted my troops, literally on the gangway, turned them round, and I was about to march off, and this chap was blue in the face with rage, and he said to me, "Get these men." I said, "I'm sorry, they come on with the rifles on, not at all." And I said, "You don't think that I would ask you to scrap your guns, do you? Or sink your ship?" I said, "No, I'm sorry." He said, "Oh, come on, you silly A.B. And very, very, very rude language. And we galloped on. He was quite all right after that. And we got home, and we all got back to Southampton.
Was the ship crowded?
Yes, pretty full. I think that we would be about halfway through the loading. But it with the French rail authorities were extremely good at getting all the trains they could, anything that they could get to get troops to the coast, they did. So whatever is said about capitulation of the French, I can only say they were badly led, they were badly armed, but who are we to say anything?
The journey back, what are your memories of the journey? Was it a quiet journey?
Across the Channel? Fast. That destroyer moved very, very quickly, and I didn't go below decks. I was too apprehensive even then to go below decks. I stayed watching France and then watching for UK, and how pleased I was to see Southampton heave into view.
What was
the chaps were absolutely thrilled. They were laughing their heads off, and I thought, until we get out of this, there's still time for the German Air Force to bomb us, because by that time Dunkirk was finished, Nauvoo was finished, Calais was finished. They were working their way down, but thank God we still had the Navy. And the men were cheering and laughing and talking about home and everything else, and they were talking about different incidents that had struck them on the way back. They were laughing about the day we slept one day in a cemetery on the way down, and I was laid out on a tombstone with my steel helmet under my head, and it rained that day very heavily, and I woke up at dusk and I thought, "Christ, I'm drowning." And my bat was howling with laughter because my steel helmet was full of water. They thought that was the funniest thing they'd seen. Odd little things like that tickled the troops. They're very, very happy people.
Do you remember the name of the ship?
No, I'm sorry, I don't. I think that it's a big responsibility. You see, what people now, after all these years, what people tend to forget was, I was a second lieutenant. I was a territorial officer. I had never been in charge of anything else greater than a platoon. And I was used to the command of the company commander, the battalion commander, the brigadier, and everything was orderly. And when it's like that, and you're thrust into a position where you're responsible for 100 men, it it weighs rather on your shoulders. And my other officers were nice chaps, but they had no even less training than I had, and so everything, every responsibility was on my shoulders, and I had the that to worry about it. So no, this is why I'm sorry I can't give you places and dates and times so well, because all I cared for was getting my chaps back to a proper situation intact.